is 855 KPFT car to make your donation. Thanks. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Casting in multiple missing geek formation, it's Technology Bites.
Is that what we're doing tonight?
I think that is what we're doing tonight. This is going to be interesting. Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter D.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse
behind the board.
Working the button.
That's it. No more.
Four-person show tonight.
Yeah.
It's going to be the perfect show.
It will be the most awesome show ever. Oh, all right. So, yes, Barrett and Flicted are the advance away team on Planet DEF CON.
We gave them their red shirts.
Here's
and
your
sent
red
them
shirt.
Ahead.
If the goon shirt is red for all goons this year, then Flicted will be a red shirt at DEF CON because he's a goon, which is the staff, the volunteer staff that runs security and set up the talks and all of that stuff at the DEF CON hacking convention. Wow. So, yeah, I'll be going there tomorrow. I'm pretty excited. You know, I don't have the kind of legs that used to successfully carry me the great distances that it takes to walk between two full-size casinos in Las Vegas. But DEF CON is moved last year to Paris and Bally's. So
right.
It's taken up two casinos worth of conference rooms and
you just got to be smart when you're planning out your sessions. Make sure you don't bounce back and forth between the hotels.
Or keep your standards real low. Yeah, what's this one in the next room? That's what I want to learn about.
Track? What do you mean, what track? I'm on the track of what's the next room with a speaker in it. Oh, that line's too long. No, we'll see.
But I'm on the this conference room track.
I'm
going wherever this rascal's going.
Yes, they've got the space now. I could rascal it. Well, I don't know if they did it last year, but several years ago in the old Rio location, they had closed circuit TV, so you could actually watch the talks on your television in your room. We called it BedCon.
Nice. Could you stream it to your device that you were too stupid to not connect to the Wi-Fi network with?
No. Although that's the other thing. I've kind of been lax in hardening my hardware, but we'll see how it goes.
Your hardware's not hard enough?
Well, there's a medicine for
not
that.
For DEF CON.
Not for DEF CON.
Side effects of DEF CON may include identity theft, doxing.
I mean, basically, don't you just...
Unexplained charges on your credit card.
Turn it off.
Turn it off, or turn your firewall on, disable the Wi-Fi, and only use an Ethernet cable, or... Is even that's too scary?
Well, what I tend to do, and so far has worked out for me well enough, is I use the hotspot on my phone.
Oh,
In my room, so I feel like I'm not, hopefully not hitting some rogue femto out there, you never know.
Or use the free Wi-Fi, but at, like, the Cosmo or something. Well, something way on the other side.
Allegedly, the press Wi-Fi, the press room Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. is secure, air-quoted. They do tout the press Wi-Fi, so... Yeah.
Is it like they've taken measures to make it secure, or is it just sort of like a truce and nobody hacks the press Wi-Fi?
I don't know if that kind of truce would hold. I think I think they actually harden that network somewhat. Yeah. I don't know. Who knows? I mean, you walk into what's interesting at DEF CON is you walk into the main the showroom, the vendor showroom floor where all the exhibits are and stuff, and there's a group that is, you know, they have what they call the wall of sheep, where they capture plain text passwords being sent from.
Wow.
So you see the email. They don't actually show the password anymore. They used to. But now they shadow most of the password or part of it. But they display enough so that the person could look up and say, that's my email address, and that's probably my password. It's called the wall of sheep. So
have you been on the wall of sheep, Jay?
No.
Would a VPN connecting to a VPN through the Wi-Fi? I mean, once you've connected to the Wi-Fi, wouldn't that pretty much or?
I would imagine that a VPN would help.
You probably have to be careful not to initiate your VPN if you are not sure about the security of your connection to the Wi-Fi, because then you'll just get man in the middle and your VPN will come to naught.
Yeah. So if the problem is that, you know, if there's a spoofed hotspot masquerading as the hotel Wi-Fi, or if the hotel Wi-Fi is just compromised, they, you know, you fire up the VPN and I don't know what would happen. You think every time you think you're safe, you find out that you're not. But what I do have to do is I got my phone not set to automatically connect to any Wi-Fis, but I do like to pop up the and look what the list of available Wi-Fi hotspots is.
Please, that's please connect to me. What's the worst thing that could happen, Net?
This is fine.net. Well,
see, nowadays, I guess actually, I mean, a device like, say, an Amazon Fire tablet is about $50. That's not too bad for basically a burner. You know, you could use it as sort of a burner device. Obviously, you're not going to check your personal email or do those kinds of things, but it would let you still be, you know, get some online from free Wi-Fi without really worrying about giving away your credentials.
Yeah, just find yourself a little sacrificial phone and...
Yeah, a cheapo that you can use without... And then walk around like you're the big Mark, you know?
Yeah!
While you're tablet. Oh, man! You know, I love to check on my stocks while I'm here in Vegas.
Yep, everything's fine. I don't even... I don't even have security on this. I just use it.
I want to get a hold of it's fun listening to the casino employees talk about the memo that they got about this thing coming up called DEF CON and what they should do to protect themselves. But there was actually, and I don't have a copy of it now, but there was actually somebody got a hold of the memo that came out and told people.
Warning.
Hackers.
Know what your ATMs are supposed to look like. And if you see an ATM that is not a normal ATM, do not use it. It is not a new convenient ATM for you to use.
I'm perfectly okay with throwing my money down the blackjack hole, but I don't want some hacker to get it.
That's right. The only person who can be throwing away your money is you.
That's right. I want to light the match. All right, well, we're glad you could tune in. This is going to be, a minimal host connectivity issue or episode of Technology Bites, but we got Peter Hughes in San Antonio. We got Lee Hutchinson here. It's Hutchinson, right?
Yes.
I mean, on the plus side.
I was so confident side. I knew I had to be messing it up just once.
No, you got it.
On the plus side, the two people who aren't here, with the exception of Groovehouse, speak the least. So we've got the ones who talk the most.
Shut up, Groovehouse.
Fill in the space.
Yeah, it's true. It's not like, you know, it's obvious that they're gone. If you don't pay too close attention, it seems like a full show.
Every time I wish Groovehouse would talk less.
It goes on and on. So yeah, it'll be a good show. I'm already tired thinking about all the walking I'm going to do this weekend. So I feel like the grumpy old hacker band.
Are you going to take some time and do the Vegas gambling thing, or are you beyond that?
No, I'm not necessarily beyond it. The one time I went to Vegas and enjoyed gambling, I was able to sit at a blackjack table with a group of people that I knew. Mm-hmm. Not really well, they were coworkers. I was there for a conference for work, but we sat at the table and we all knew each other and we all played together, played against the dealer, and we were able to nurse about 4 or 5 hours out of the experience.
Wow.
We didn't win any. I didn't.
No, but that's 4 or 5 good hours.
Yeah, 4 or 5 good hours, and I think
and they're bringing you drinks.
Bringing me drinks, so I lost a couple $100, but I was very entertained and very, you know, liquored up and I had a good time. But I can't. It just going to a blackjack table or going to any game where you don't know the people and trying to play just for the sake of playing has no real appeal to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I wish that it did.
Losing my money has no real appeal to me.
Yeah.
Well, in the right context, I guess. Yeah. You know,
my dad used to go to Vegas regularly. He used to actually went to CES before it was a big deal. It was when it was really a, you know, insider kind of trade show.
He told you he went to CES. Uh-huh.
Yeah. His thing was the best time he had in Vegas on the gambling thing. He finally had stopped gambling. The one time he did fine was he had lost, you know, couple $100 at the tables, and then when he went in the bar there was a cup at the place where he sat and got his drink, and the cup was full of chips and they were more than what he lost, so he cashed them in and called it a win.
Whoa. Somebody came back later and was like, where are my chips?
Well,
he waited, you know, made sure that whoever it was had forgotten them, but it was the only time he came out ahead, so.
Stroke of luck.
Well, the first time I went to Vegas was a long time ago, and it was when they still had the slots would still dump coins, but now they print out a ticket, which and they make coin noises electronically, which is terrible. But I remember, you know, we got to the airport, and the guy that I travel with, John, said, "Okay, here's the trick to Vegas," and so we walked around the airport lobby or around the baggage claim area, and we kept hitting machines, you know, the blackjack, not the blackjack, what do you call those?
Slot machines.
Yes, thank you. Slot machines. And people arriving in Vegas didn't know how to Vegas. So so they put their money in and they'd play and they'd win, but they wouldn't cash out.
Nice.
So we walked around to the machines, and sure enough, we're just like, broop, cash out. So we were up like probably 60, 70 bucks a piece.
It's like checking the slot on the payphone, but like
it's exactly like that. And I'd forgotten all about that source of income from my youth, because that was actually a good source of income. Yes. I meticulously checked every payphone change slot. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Vending machines, cigarette machines.
That any vending machine, and of course loose bottles for deposits.
Oh, yeah.
No. You know, if you hit the jackpot, if you could find a couple of 30, people didn't tend to throw 32-ounce bottles of Coke out the window, but occasionally they would. So that was worth at least 25 cents in the regular bottles, 12-ounce bottles.
Yeah, in high school we had bottle drives where you'd go door to door and get people to, because they didn't feel like they were giving you money, but it added up when you had a case of bottles.
Yeah.
They were nickel a bottle or something, 10 cents for the 32 like months.
I haven't. So I mean, I do Vegas once a year at least, and have every year since about my first trip was in 2003. I remember that it was for the Microsoft Management Summit in 2003, But I have played table games maybe twice. It's just really intimidating because I'm usually there. You know, it's always for business, except for maybe one or two trips. But I'm usually there. It's just me. You know, because the daytime activities are all filled up with whatever I'm there to be doing, whatever trade show or whatever I'm there to see. So, you know, when I have time to go down and actually do a gambling thing, it's really intimidating because it's usually late at night and the people in the casinos are the crazy people who are gambling at 12 or 1 in the morning. And it's like, I don't know, do I really want to go up and be like, what are the rules to this game? How do I play this blackjack? So I always end up just going to slot machines. And, you know, I think I'm probably down a couple of $100 for lifetime losings in Vegas. Never really more than just a couple of times I've done the table games. It's just too intimidating.
Yeah, I remember one time welcome to Gambling Bites.
I was driving through Houston.
Yeah,
Jay thought he had a system one time. And
no, there was one time that I got up to, it was the second, there was only two times I remember gambling and really enjoying it. One was that blackjack experience I told you about. And the mm-hmm. other one was I got talked into going to a craps table. And craps just intimidates the literal craps out of me.
It's like magic. It's like mysticism to me. I have no idea. I know there are rules, but I have absolutely no idea what they are.
But what I did,
just people rolling the dice and yelling.
And yeah, and so basically I stood there with someone who knew how to play the game and I just chased them. I followed their moves and had a great time. Won some money.
Put your chips on this square. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, now I get more chips.
That's
awesome.
Yeah, I've never been to Vegas. My one casino experience was in Milwaukee. And it was everything you'd expect from a casino in Milwaukee. It was some like really moribund, you know, burned out warehouse part of town that they were trying to revitalize. And it was all dark in there. And I did sit at the table and it's like, yeah, my peak gambling experience was the time when I hit on 15 and or 16 and I got, you know, I won. I beat the dealer because they like cocked an eye at me when I hit.
And that was it. You're done now.
That was it. Yeah. Yeah. And so I won money that I promptly lost, I'm sure. But yeah, they were like, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah.
Never need to go back. You're all gambled out.
Yeah, well, I can save myself a ton of money if I didn't.
I will say that the one thing that I wish that I could do a little bit more, and I just don't have when I go to DEF CON, I don't really have the time or the energy to make it happen. But and I'd really like to find somebody who would go with me to do it. But the shows, like I went to go see the Blue Man Group, and I went ahead and bought good tickets and got down close, and I had a great time. It was a great show.
Did you get splashed with colorful liquid from their crazy light drums or whatever?
No, I wasn't that close, but I did get covered in tissue paper as they rolled that down across the whole audience. And the other one was, because it was in the casino where DEF CON was happening, I went to see Penn and Jillette. Or Penn Jillette.
Penn and Teller.
Penn and Teller.
Penn and Jillette, yeah. The Razor Show.
Yes. So,
it was smooth, close, and refreshing. No, I saw Penn and Teller, and it was a great show.
They do a good show. Me and Laura saw them just last year, maybe 2 years ago, but it was at the Rio.
Well, it was really funny because we were there for DEF CON, and I remember tweeting something and tweeting at Penn Jillette, and from backstage he tweeted back.
Nice.
That was pretty cool. All right, so what we're going to do now, since we've wasted all that, not wasted, but taken up so much valuable time talking about gambling in Vegas with hackers, hacking for dollars. We're going to take it now to San Antonio with Peter Hughes and the Technology Bites Info Shot. Take it away, Info Shot.
It's the Technology Bites Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Well, kind of like casinos. You know the deal, you know, the casino thing. The house always wins. Well, the broadband industry is trying to be the casino, and so this is a story from Ars Technica. 6 weeks after federal judges preserved net neutrality rules for the broadband industry, the ISPs are seeking a review of the decision, so they're going to try again. Their attempt to overturn the Federal Communications Commission's rules were rejected when a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit voted 2-1 in favor of the FCC. Now they're asking for what's called an en banc review, which is the, like, full court, all of the judges, instead of just a three-judge panel. If that fails and they don't do it, then it could go to the Supreme Court. But apparently the odds of them winning there appear to be long. There were several petitions submitted. One came from the National Cable and Telecommunications Association and the American Cable Association. There were also filings from the CTIA, the Wireless Association, which is the mobile broadband industry's primary lobbying group, the United States Telecom Association, and CenturyLink, representing DSL and fiber providers. They go into rural areas and stuff, is the CenturyLink stuff. And a small Texas ISP named Alamo Broadband, for some reason, filed it. NCTA said, quote, "We don't celebrate this petition, but we believe this action is necessary to correct unlawful action by the FCC." The cable group claims to support net neutrality protections, but not the related reclassification of internet service providers as common carriers. While the FCC passed net neutrality rules using weaker underlying authority in 2010, Verizon sued to overturn them. This proved to be a hollow victory because it led to the FCC using the stronger Title II common carrier authority to put the broadband industry under its control with the latest set of net neutrality rules. So, you know, the thing on this, though, that, you know, circling back, there's all the legalese stuff, but circling back, the deal is this is the providers wanting to be able to charge multiple people for the same bandwidth. If you bear with me, you know, when you know, Netflix pays for their bandwidth and you pay for your bandwidth, and what the industry is wanting is that since Netflix is successful and they're using that bandwidth to sell stuff to you, that then somehow Netflix owes them money beyond what you're paying for the service. So it's a little, so frankly, it's kind of hard to have sympathy. And if you also followed if you followed Technology Bytes news, in the past some months, we reported a few months ago that apparently the cost of providing bandwidth has fallen through the floor for these providers. And so they are making higher profits even without doing anything. You know, by leaving your rates the same, they are making more money because the cost of providing broadband has been declining. And so when your provider has a cap and your provider wants to find a way to charge you for charge other services that you'll indirectly end up paying for. You know, if Netflix costs go up, then they're going to raise their price to you a buck. So it is going to cost you money. And so you're going to pay twice for the same you're going to pay twice for the same bandwidth, and the poor internet service providers who are making pretty good money doing this stuff without much competition. It's another reason why rates stay up. Sadly, if they lose in this case, they'll have to just be satisfied with the profit numbers they're getting now. And, you know, have to compete on their service, at least in the small places, in the points where they have competition. You know, for instance, if you notice any place that has Google Fiber, the speeds in those places go up from AT&T and, you know, Comcast and Time Warner, and the prices go down. Everywhere else, not so much. The prices stay up. The speeds have improved in some places, but they don't improve as much as they do when Google comes to town. And so it kind of shows you what, if there was real competition, there would be. And, you know, it'd be nice if they spent their time working on competing instead of spending their money on lawyers and lobbyists to try and influence the laws. And here's one: when you're working out, if you're feeling the burn, maybe you need to check if you have the company's called Basis. And it's Peak Fitness Watches. Intel owns them, but the company is called Basis. the Basis Peak watch. They're recalling all of them because the watch can overheat, which could result in burns or blisters on the skin surface, according to Intel Senior VP Josh Walden. It is important that you stop using your watch immediately and return it. So I guess Intel still hasn't quite overcome that overheating processor problem. I've heard that they're going to offer the next generation one is going to have a big heat sink on it, or they were going to do that, but then it covered up the face of the watch so you couldn't see. And then the liquid cooling one, nobody wanted the backpack. The deal is, unlike many smartwatches that monitor heart rate only occasionally, the Peak continually monitors heart rate using an active LED on the back of the device. That LED appears to have caused the burn injuries if the watch overheated. Now they've started offering refunds, and they're recalling all of them. So if you have a Basis Peak, you probably want to look at going to their website and turning it back in, unless you want to go, you know, feel the burn multiple ways. And finally, this one's an interesting one, and just kind of, you know, you just wonder why, because it's one of those where I'm, at least my experience in texting, it's true is when you text, think about it, when you're texting, do you do punctuation at the end of a text? The deal is apparently, you know, putting a period at the end of a sentence on a text has been starting to get a lot of attention. People have been noticing how we don't, how fewer and fewer people are using it. That the idea is that when you use a period at the end of a text, that it makes you sound angry or standoffish. And earlier this year, psychologist Danielle Gunraj tested how people perceive one sentence text messages that used a period at the end of the sentence. Participants thought these text messages were more insincere than those that didn't have a period. But when researchers then tested the same messages in handwritten notes, they found the use of a period did not influence how the messages were perceived. So why does it, you know, their study, that, you know, they had a question of, you know, why would you feel it was insincere? And the answer could have something to do with the term used by linguist John J. Gumpers called, quote, situational code switching, which is when we change how we talk depending on where we are, who we're talking to, or how we're communicating. They say, you know, common example on the code switching thing is the way we talk in a job interview versus at a bar with friends, or on the radio versus off the radio, perhaps, for our show. Scholars originally investigated situational code switching in spoken language because it was used in both casual and formal settings. In the past, written language was always kind of formal because it was, you know, books or written documents. However, with texts, people are treating it more like speech. And so apparently if you use a period in it, it comes off as overly formal. So think about that one when you use it. Here's an irony though. So if you want to come across as insincere, go ahead and put a period at the end of your sentence, period, full stop. But the other one that seems to me to be counterintuitive, I get the one with the period on it, but apparently repeating a lot of vowels and a lot of exclamation marks shows sincerity in tone in text messages, in case you wondered. You know, the whole "I'm so sorry!" exclamation point. and then they showed a message that was like that, and then showed the standard version of it without the extra punctuation and stuff, and it came across as, you know, less sincere. So you wonder, is this going to bleed over into how people write in the real world? And someday will the period disappear, or will it mean you're insincere when you write that way? I guess we'll have to watch and find out. And that's the news.
All right. So, yeah.
Period.
So, you know, it's only been very, very, very recently that I have started to use emoticons at all. Mm. Like, I've realized...
Are you talking actual graphical emoji?
No, just a smiley face.
Like an old school smiley face.
Mm. Which some programs will turn into a smiley face if you're not careful.
Yeah, I end up with the involuntary ones where you do the, you know,
colon close parentheses
and it turns it into a smiley face.
But I discovered that, you know, one of the things you don't tend... You know, when you're dealing with your coworkers through electronic media... constantly, and even when I'm dealing with my readers of the Houston Chronicle, you know, because I tend to send pretty short, like, you know, here, try this, do that, or whatever. It's just a sentence, and I've gotten feedback over the years of people just thinking that I was mad or thinking that I was being short, or you know, when you get an email back from especially when I'm dealing with some of my readers for the Chronicle, I get like, well, you don't have to take that attitude with me. It's like, oh, what? So
you ain't even seen attitude yet.
So only recently I've decided that, you know, if I don't want to take any chances, I'll throw a smiley face on the end of it or something, or say, you know, and have a great day or good luck, or I'll even actually word it out and just say something nice. And I feel so disingenuous when I do it. Mm. Because if I didn't have to do it, if it would just be my message in the tone that I was thinking it in, which was just nonchalant or casual, I'm fine. I don't have a problem being nice to people. But when I have to convince people that I really am nice, that just feels like I'm being false. So, like, if you're going to be all happy because you got a smiley face, then I don't know. It just bothers me.
I'm just going to imagine you with pigtails whenever you have a smiley face in your email. It's like, thanks for writing in.
Jay
Lee with pigtails.
Ew.
Well, what you should do then is go totally the opposite and just put a smiley face after everything, no matter the content, no matter what it is. Like, my condolences on your loss, smiley face. Just like, every email now has a smiley face in it.
I think emojis, they can be the ultimate non sequiturs.
So Mr. Johnson lost his laptop at the airport, smiley face.
Well, just pick one that you have no idea what it means and just use that frequently.
Like,
there was one, somebody posted something, you know, where they captured, you know, their deal, and it was like, I just can't deal with you, you're too weird, and they replied with like some emoji that had, it's like a chick bursting out of an egg and it's kind of got its wings out. And they like the, and you know, I can't understand you. You're too weird. And they texted like three of those.
I will never
and they
use
said something
those.
Else. They texted no. more of. That's all they texted at this person.
Although I do want to create a macro that will just let me single key put in the shrug emoji.
You can do that. I don't do single key, but I've got slash shrug.
Really?
Mapped. Yeah, it'll do it. And I'll do it. And does it in the spotlight when it just slash shrug and it'll. Well, now that I've done it once, hold on. Here we go. Slash shrug and it'll. Bloop.
How do you do that?
You do. You go under, if you're on Mac, if you're on OS 10,
and I
you
am.
Go under System Preferences, and once you're in System Preferences, you go to Keyboard, and under Keyboard there is a Shortcuts tab, and then inside the Shortcuts tab, then you have to. Oh wait, maybe this isn't it.
Oh no, I was just getting there.
I know it's in here somewhere. Maybe it's there's a. I thought it was under
Input
Shortcuts.
Sources.
No, maybe it's under. Oh, it's the text tab.
There's a
substitutions window that you can add, replace like strings to search for and then strings to replace with. So I've just got slash shrug mapped to that. Now it'll only do it in, gosh, I don't know what we call them these days. I was going to say it'll only do it in native Cocoa applications, but I guess that's not a thing anymore. It'll only do it in applications that. Are fully compatible with whatever Mac OS's like text replacement accessibility API is or whatever. So it won't do it like in Firefox, for example, which is a horrible hacked together mess of a browser. None of those.
It'll work in TweetDeck,
it will work in TweetDeck. It'll work in anything that's like a fully native Mac application.
I've done it. I've implemented the solution as presented by Lee Hutchinson.
Yeah, you'll get it one day. See, this is kind of like the old Technology Bites. See, you had a question, and then we talked through an answer, and everybody's learned something.
Hello, would you like to ask a question on the air? Yes, I would.
I have spyware, Jay. Can you help me get
this? Must murder! Must
go.
Murder!
That's why I don't answer the phone.
Amongst many reasons.
Jay, I'm running Windows PX on my Packard Bell, and I was wondering if you could help me. Because it's a little
Packard
slow.
Bell.
And
well, the first thing you should probably do is add another meg of RAM.
How many mega dogs of RAM should I have? Do you recommend at least 3 mega dogs of RAM?
Help me remember. It was a caller that called in and talked about his Citrus Logic.
Citrus Logic
on his Petunium.
Wow.
Yeah, that was
awesome.
Oh
man, no, I had. If we're going to devolve into Tales from Tech Support, very
Tales
briefly,
from Tech Support.
I had, for those of you who don't know, I actually worked phone support for Gateway for.
I thought you were going to say the word phone support for some gay.
No, for Gateway.
Gateway.
The cow spotted computer box.
G-A-P-J-Y-T.
Yeah. The cow spotted computer box company. It was my first tech support job. And, we could do stories from that for hours, but I won't. I will tell you one call, though, where I had someone correct me very, very pointedly about my computer terminology. One of the things that you did when, you know, I just remember the script. It was, thank you for calling Gateway Support. My name is Lee. My badge number is 500771. Can I have your system serial number, please? And then, you know, they have to look up their serial number, and then you put it into that crazy application, Vantiv or whatever they used, and it would pull up all the information. Anyway... I had a caller one day who, I said, you know, can I have your serial number, please? And the caller was like, well, where do I find that? And I was like, well, okay. I can have it either.
I bet
off
you were very pleasant to deal with.
I would start it out that way.
Yeah.
By the end of that job, I was totally horrible. You know, you could look on the back of the monitor and I could take that, or you could look on the back of the computer, the actual computer on the floor. And the person was like, what do you mean the computer on the floor? I was like, you know, the computer part, the part with the computer. And the caller was like, oh yes, that's called the CPU. Like telling me that. Like, oh, all right. Well, you could look on the back of that and get the serial number, and the person couldn't find it. And so then I said, well, you could check the back of the monitor also. I can look that up too. And they were like, monitor? What, when you say monitor, what do you mean? It's like, well, you know, the screen in front of you. And she's like, yes, that's what it's called. The screen. I'm like, you know, that just kind of set the tone for the whole call. And then I was at multiple points, I wanted to say, like, why, if you know all this, why are you calling me? Why don't you figure it out yourself since you seem to know all the answers already?
Oh, or start doing it really wrong. Me, well, hooked up to the thinky box.
Yes, why don't you look at the bottom of the magnet capacitor and read me the number of gigajoules that are in the readout? And then I can look up your system and tell you all of your answers.
I like to cut them off and say, if you're the smart one here, why are you calling me?
the best calls, as soon as you tell me to shut up, I'll get off the support stories.
Please, rant.
The best call, so this was in, when was this? This would be 1997 and 1998. The best calls were the ones where, at the time, Gateway was experimenting with being a cut rate internet service provider. They had this thing called gateway.net that you could buy. It was like an AOL kind of competitor thing where they had a captive portal and you would dial in with your modem. And they had some sort of like scheme where, like, instead of dialing 800 numbers, they used, what are they called, those 1010 codes, where there'd be like a 1010 three number code and then a number, and like that's how they would defer the cost of the call. Anyway, whatever, it was horribly janky and it never worked. And you knew when somebody was calling in with a gateway.net question that one of two things was going to happen. One, the person was going to, you were going to be able to dump the call immediately, because you would ask them, like, okay, so you're having trouble with gateway.net. What happens when you try to dial in? And they'll be like, well, you know, I dial and it gives me a, you know, it connects, but then it gives me an error code. I'm like, well, I need to get that error code. Can you dial in and tell me what it is? Well, I only have one phone line, so I'd have to hang up. And you're like, yes, because you knew they'd hang up and dial in and call back in, and somebody else would take the call. And be like, that would just be not your problem anymore. But the worst ones were those calls where that person would have, like, two phone lines. They'd be like, yes, I have a second phone line. I can dial in. And then you knew you were going to be troubleshooting GatewayNet for, like, the next, like, 3 hours, and your whole shift was going to be shot. So many memories.
We had... I remember one of the memorable calls from early in Technology Bytes was the opposite of your person who knew what everything was. You know, Jay and I were talking to the person and trying to talk them through their problem, and it literally came down to saying, okay, is the TV thing on and showing you a picture? And the answer was no. And so that's why whenever we asked them, you know, can you click on the whatever, you know, that they couldn't do it, it's because they hadn't even turned it on when they were waiting.
I'm looking at a blind screen, man. Why can't you troubleshoot this?
I guess when we told them, you know, move the mouse or can you click on this or can you do that? The answer was no, but it wasn't really, that wasn't really the honest answer.
I had.
Now, when you became hateful in your job, did that come over you, wash over you as a result of your experience, or did you learn that from a coworker?
Well, okay, so that's an interesting question. I had so the way this job worked for folks who have never done a phone support job, the job started out with 2 weeks of 8 hours a day training because I was going to U of H at the time. They had like a daytime training and an evening training, so I'd go to class and then leave at, you know, 3 o'clock or whatever and drive downtown. It was on the 24th and 25th floor of the Metro building. Drive downtown. And then we'd have the evening class, and it would be like from 5 till like midnight or something. I don't remember the exact time, but it was an evening thing. And so for the first 2 weeks, it was like the, you know, 20 of us that were in that training class and the trainer. And like, we didn't see anybody else because it wasn't a 24-hour call center. The place shut down in the evenings, and it was just us. And that part was really neat because it was like just a small group of people. We were learning a bunch of stuff and figuring out how to do all these calls, and it was great. And then the last couple of days were like, as we were transitioning into being, you know, real boys, like real people and not like fake trainees, they had us shadowing live calls. So we'd go out on the floor and we'd take our little headsets and plug into the secondary port on somebody's phone and watch an actual tech go through the call. And those were like some of the most fascinating experiences of my life because there were like some techs that were really good and there were some techs that were just like almost pretending like they were trying to be Ferris Bueller cool for you to watch them. And they would like put the customer on mute and make fun of them to me sitting there and be like, can you believe this guy calling in? He doesn't even know what his modem is. And like go off mute and be like, yes, sir. Well, why don't you type in this? And then put him on mute again. What an idiot. And so, and it, I wasn't really expecting that. I was, you know, I was young and impressionable. I was, you know, 19, 20. And I genuinely thought that like this job was going to be great because I'm going to be able to
help people.
Yes. I'm going to be able to take this job and it's just going to be like, I know all this stuff and people are going to ask me questions and I'm going to help them. And at the end of the shift, everything's going to be great. But anybody who has worked a support job of any kind knows that that feeling is very quickly crushed out of you because it's not that you don't help people. I mean, every once in a while, sometimes even multiple times in a shift, you'll have great calls that go really well. And you feel like everybody, when the call is over, has learned something. Everybody's happy and you get off the phone and everything's great. But for every one of those you have, there's 10 that are either mediocre or terrible. And it is a very Sisyphean job because no matter how good you are, the phone never stops ringing. It doesn't matter how good of a job you do. It doesn't matter how much of an amazing save you did. It doesn't matter if you helped this poor crying college student rescue a research paper that saved them, you know, weeks of work and you found where they'd saved it and fixed it for them. I mean, it doesn't matter because the next call is going to happen as soon as you get off the phone. And then when you're done with that, the next call is going to happen. When you're done with that, the next call is going to happen. And it very, very quickly got – so on – There's a Usenet group, a very famous Usenet group. I've talked about it before. It's the Scary Devil Monastery. The alt.sysadmin.recovery is what it's really. The Scary Devil Monastery is the, what do you call it when you mix up letters? The
dyslexic?
Anagram. It's an anagram. The alt.sysadmin.recovery. It's a very famous Usenet group where system administrators and support people will commiserate. And the conventional wisdom in alt.sysadmin recovery is that the typical amount of time it takes any support person to go from fresh to burnout in a tech support job is 18 months. If you have a job in tech support for 18 months, that's the mean burnout time, at which point you are basically ready to just start stabbing people. I lasted at that gateway job for 3 months. 90 days before. Wow. Well, it's not that the office ended up closing. They laid everybody off, and when it happened, you know, it was the classic layoff where, like, mid shift, everybody is called into the conference room, and it's like, all right, well, here is this piece of paper, and there are now security guards standing behind you, and if you will please exit the building in an orderly fashion, you will have your checks mailed. It was like a very, you know, very efficient, like, chop, you're done layoff. And when it happened, I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? You know, I need a job. How am I going to put gas in my car? But, like, as I was walking from conference room to car, each step got lighter and lighter and lighter. And I realized that, you know, I don't care if I have to go and work at, you know, Best Buy, or if I have to go and work at McDonald's or whatever. Like, I'm not working here anymore, and I'm so happy about that. I didn't realize how bad the job was making me feel. And I know that sounds like first world problems. Wah, poor guy has to sit in a cubicle all day long.
I have to find release valves. I mean, I really, really do love helping people. Mm-hmm. I really do like, it's not always necessarily about the benefit of mankind. It's, I enjoy the thought puzzles. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the problem solving. I enjoy saying, okay, here's the problem, and how quickly can I take it from problem to resolution? Mm-hmm. And test my skills and my knowledge. You know, I had a good one today. I was on the phone with a woman in Sweden. Actually, she was in Stockholm. And I'm always happy when they, you know, when I'm talking to our international coworkers.
Did you have Stockholm syndrome by the time you were done?
Well, that can speak and understand English. You know, yeah. It's my language. I have supported people in Spanish using Google Translate and managed to pull it out. But I enjoy the challenge. And she had a strange Excel problem and worked on it. Then thank God for remote control tools. Thank God.
Oh, yeah.
Send a link to someone and they can click it and it installs the program and it shows me their screen.
Yes. Just let me see. If I can see it, I can fix it.
But going back to the original question of learning how to be hateful in tech support, which I do think that a lot of people that I meet that are good at tech support are genuinely snarky, sarcastic, mm-hmm. kind of... You wonder why they're in the business at all, but it's just part of what makes that. And I think I learned it from other people. I remember my first support job, the guy at Neosoft, John, who was responsible for building all the computers and installing software and all that stuff. He was an ass. He was just an ass. I mean, you go ask him a question. He's like, you know, where can I find a blah, blah, blah? And he said, if it was up your butt, you'd know where it was. Like, just hateful like that. But on the flip side of that coin was he was really good at what he did. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, if he needed something and he was the one that could do it, he would do it.
Yeah.
And that it was just this dichotomy that I learned over the years.
I think sometimes, not all the time, some people are just jerks, but I think sometimes it's just a natural response to, it's just try to for the other person that you're talking to, because murder them for being so stupid. You're calling in, sometimes you get the tech who doesn't know what they're doing, and you want to murder them for being so stupid because they can't help you.
Well, it's frustrating. I find also the frustration with, you know, I know my skill set, I know my limits, and I know what I can do. And it's like, okay, that problem, totally, I can solve that. That problem is going to be challenging, but I bet I can solve that. Uh-huh. This problem, I have no idea. And I need to have colleagues or coworkers that are at least as clever. I mean, I may not be the most clever person in the world, but at least as clever as me, so that they're taking on their fair share of the tough ones.
And you want people who can complement your skills with their own, and maybe you're better here and they're better there.
But it's tough when you work, and I do have coworkers that seem sometimes that they would rather just pass the problem. You know, they're, right. You know, I think that's true in any work environment. You've got workers that work hard and you got workers that slack. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's like, you know, I'm so OCD about the whole thing that I'll take on all the problems and work them, because I sometimes find out that I'll let something go and I say, you know what, I'm going to let someone else deal with that. That's, you know, there's a whole team of us. Somebody else can work that. And then they'll work it, and they won't do anything, and they'll let it slide. And then the person who's getting the help will say, you know, Jay's always been real responsive. Hey, can you tell me why Bob isn't taking care of my blah, blah, blah? So that's pretty frustrating.
Well, and Bob is probably gaming the metrics on the back end, too. So from management's perspective, Bob's a genius. Because Bob is hitting all of his ticket closure rate numbers. Bob gets great feedback metrics, and he always seems to, you know, be totally calm and in control. And, you know,
Why are you so stressed out, Jay?
You're not even making your metrics. Blue, why can't you be more like Bob?
I'll kill you now. Well, that's a great conversation. I did want to, while we, you know, I'm not really good at judging how much time we have left. We got about 9 minutes before the top of the hour. But I was had something brought to my attention from a friend of mine on the Facebooks and the Twitters that wanted me to pay attention to this thing. And it looks interesting in this. I don't see what Lee might think about it, but MacroFab. MacroFab.com has a thing going on right now called the it's called the ISS Send Your Design into Orbit, the ISS Challenge. And so if you go to, I don't wonder if they have this linked on their main page, so I don't have to search for it. But if you go to macrofab.com/ISS-challenge-2016, it's the ISS Challenge. Not the ISIS Challenge, but the ISS Challenge.
What is it? Macrofab.com/
ISS-challenge-2016. And they're having this contest about designing things to be used or sent up to the space station.
Interesting.
And I don't know it.
What this company does, I guess they do.
They do
microfabrication or macro fabrication.
They do apparently on demand.
This is interesting. It's not. Yeah, it's not 3D printing. It's like bashing together boards or something.
Yeah, I was brought to my attention, and I started looking at it, and, you know, I would like to make a space ball peen hammer.
Yeah.
Or something, or set it up. But if you're interested in this, you might want to go check it out and maybe have your, if you're a designer of some kind and you want to have something featured on the space station.
Send your stuff to space.
Send your stuff to space. I want to send, you know, if I could get my one of my band's CDs sent into space.
Now, see, it doesn't, they're actually really,
they're a little vague about it. Huh?
So they're a little vague about it. Yeah, now's your chance to put your imagination and creativity to work to dream up and design new tools and devices that astronauts can use. Okay, I see. So it's like,
okay, then
it's like tools and stuff.
You have to go to the next couple of pages and look. And I don't know. It's their prizes are a 3D printer or a fluke meter or a Mouser Genius T-shirt.
Get the fluke meter.
What's a fluke meter?
A fluke network scanner. They're super expensive. Yeah. You can do like cable testing and line testing and stuff with them. Go find the troll that lives in your network closet and ask him what a fluke meter is, and he'll be like, "Why do you have one? Go away!" But yeah, and then he'll, after you appease him with whatever offering the network troll wants, he'll tell you about it. Flukes are generally pretty expensive. No, I did a I did a big write up on the Neutral Buoyancy Laboratory, the pool where NASA does zero G training and simulation for astronauts, and I got to talk a lot with the suit and tool lab folks, and got to look at a lot of the tools that they use on orbit. This is actually a really interesting competition because there are really interesting designs that you have to take into account. There are parameters you have, like they have a drill that they use on orbit to, you know, screw bolts in and out. And it's called a PGT, a pistol grip tool. And it looks like, you know, it looks sort of like a chrome plated, you know, like a Bosch drill that you'd get, like a cordless drill, but it's specially geared so that it doesn't have any counter torque. So you can sit there and like drill with it and, you know, attach or detach a bolt, and it won't impart momentum back up your arm to you, because in microgravity that could, you know, disorient you and screw you up. And there was a thing, my wife's listening, she knows more about this than I do. There was like a memo that went out a few years ago because astronauts were taking the PGTs and were attaching them to fixed bolts and then in the inside, not out in suits, and were pulling the trigger and spinning themselves around, and it was like messing up the calibration of the PGTs, and NASA was like, astronauts, please stop spinning yourself around using your cordless drills. It's messing up their very expensive calibration. So this is cool. This is a neat competition. It sounds like you could design, you know, like recoilless hammers or whatever, interesting space tools.
Well, the guy behind Macrofab I used to work with back way back at NSYNC, Chris Church, and he went on to work and did a lot of the design work for...
You were in a boy band?
Yes. for Alert Logic. Okay. And he's started up this Macrofab company with good fabrication. And it looks pretty interesting. He's I was just looking at it. It looks like the company's growing. He's got quite a number of employees there now. So may have to hit him up for a job. We'll just see. But anyway, so yeah, I just want to mention that it looks kind of cool. You know, if you're into design, I need to pass this on to Mike Drever. I put this guy in touch with another guy who's in the fabrication, building this stuff.
It's a guy who knows a guy.
Guy who knows a guy building, you know. But yeah, so you could basically, what it looks like is you can design something and Macrofab will build it and then send it to the space station.
Call mine Choco Surprise. Yeah. When you bite into it, steel bolts shoot out of the butt.
Crunchy frog.
Lightly killed.
It's going to be space package crunchy frog, dehydrated crunchy frog for space. All right. Well, that music tells us it's time to take a short break, take care of some station business. So we're going to take a short break and take care of some station business. You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Lee.
And he's...
Rufus.
Cuckoo! We'll be back after these messages and a little bit more of this ambient music.
In June, KPFT was seeking listeners like you to run for our board of directors, and you responded. In the coming weeks, you'll be hearing statements by candidates seeking your vote, candidate forums in which candidates will speak to you, and more efforts to educate you about the 2016 board elections. Please note that candidate statements may not represent the views of KPFT. You're encouraged to research candidate statements, ask the general manager, and cast an informed vote in the interest of a diverse and multi-talented board of directors. Listener members are eligible to vote for our board. You can donate today to become a listener member at kpft.org. Thanks for supporting 90.1. This is KPFT Houston.
KPFT transmite por el aire 24 horas del día, 7 días de la semana y cubre diferentes tipos de gente y gente con diferentes estilos de vida. KPFT está aquí cuando usted necesita lo mejor de noticias independientes y música durante el día. Pero manteniendo este tipo de recurso no viene barato. KPFT necesita su contribución para continuar a tener esta estación única cuando usted lo necesite. Si usted está escuchando cuando se prepara por la cama o cuando se está levantando en la mañana para el trabajo, ¿por qué no hablar a la línea de departamentos de miembros a KPFT y hacer un miembro? El número es fácil. Para recordar, es 713-526-4000, extensión 314. O puede visitarnos en nuestra página kpft.org y dar su contribución. Esto es KPFT Houston.
Wow. Unceremoniously, we're back on the air. Boom! Back to Technology Bites. All right.
For Barrett time.
Yeah.
He's in Vegas.
God knows what position he's in.
Not touching that one.
Can't touch that.
Can't touch that. Too legit to quit.
This just in from Vegas. Barrett's password is... Yeah.
His password is Gingerman217.
Mustachio 68.
Mustache ride.
Okay, well, I guess maybe we should have one of them segment things, huh?
Yeah, let's get back on track. But that's a good first hour of the show. If you missed it, you can check it out on the podcast later on. It was a great first hour, just having some casual conversation in this nice reduced staff atmosphere.
That's right.
All right. So...
Bite.
So we have some positive news on the patent troll side. This one was interesting. A patent holding company that won a huge court victory against Apple had its victory completely wiped out. Its stock plunged by more than 40%. Couldn't happen to a nicer patent troll. Nevada-based Vernet X won a jury trial against Apple earlier this year. An East Texas jury, wow, knocked me over with a feather. It was an East Texas jury, huh? Ruled that Apple must pay $625 million to Vernet X for infringing four patents. The patents are said to cover Apple's VPN on demand feature as well as FaceTime. U.S. District Judge Robert Schroeder, who oversaw the trial, published an order on Friday that vacates the verdict and orders a brand new trial to begin in September. the complicated consolidated trial and repeated references to an earlier trial in which Apple was found to have infringed Vernet X patents created, quote, potential for juror confusion, unquote, and unfairly prejudiced them against Apple. The judge quoted a Vernet X attorney reciting an argument he viewed as potentially prejudicial. So it's one of those where it seems like judges are starting to get tired of some of these bizarre patent troll verdicts and looking for ways to maybe put the balances on these scales of justice to go a little different direction. So that one's interesting, and Vernet X has basically said they're going to offer products one of these days, but they've never produced anything. They have 14 employees and lease a small office in Zephyr Cove, Nevada. They have, for years, they've been saying they have plans to market various products, but for the time being, all of their income comes from licensing patents. That just seems like there's something wrong with that. They need to find a way to they've started to work on fixing that. There's one thing that there's a new legal precedent that's made it easier for defendants to win on the grounds that patents are too abstract. So, when your patent is a screen on which you can accomplish an illustration, that doesn't work. It's the process called inter partes reviews or IPRs. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it. And apparently that has knocked out hundreds of software patents, which in this particular case will not help Apple on the Vernet X's patents because those have already been tested as far as against the whole too abstract thing. But anyways, often enough we report on yet another suit from a patent troll. At least this time they didn't win this round. And then now on to cool rumors. The MacBook Air, the rumor scape is sort of all over the place on it. There's the rumors that it'd be gone entirely, that there's not going to be a MacBook Air. And now one that goes the other direction, which last month, the Japanese blog Mac Otakara reported that Apple plans to announce new MacBook Air models with USB-C ports. You know, the ports like in the new MacBook, the 12-inch skinny, super lightweight middle laptop, at least by price, that they'll be MacBook Airs with USB-C ports based on the Thunderbolt 3 protocol, which means that, you can hook up a serious monitor and stuff like that through it and send power, all this kind of stuff, that Apple would announce it by the end of June and ship them to retailers in August. Of course, now that it's late, it hasn't materialized. But there is a new report from the Taiwanese website Digitimes that Apple still has plans to release a new MacBook Air with USB-C ports after all. Doesn't give a launch time frame, but the secondary rumor suggests that Mac Otakara may have just been off on the timing. Digitimes previously reported that Apple will begin shipping new ultra-thin 13-inch and 15-inch MacBooks at the end of the second quarter, which is over, so that one failed. The report said the new MacBooks would share a design similar to the 12-inch MacBook and be thinner than the Air. So obviously that one missed. We'll see, I guess, whenever Apple does announce it. It's not not clear right now when any of this stuff might get announced. You know, the Mac lineup, though, is getting old. Other than the 2016 12-inch MacBook, Apple has not released a new MacBook Air in over 500 days. And other than an 8-gig RAM bump for the 13-inch models in April, I mean, that doesn't count as a, you know, much of an upgrade on the MacBook Air. Some believe the MacBook Air's days are numbered, but perhaps it will keep going until Apple can lower the price on the regular MacBook. The other thing that's a possibility, this is from Mac Rumors, is that the thinner MacBook Pro with USB-C ports, that they're mistaking that for a MacBook Air. But hopefully by the end of the year, Apple will maybe announce some new laptops, because I know there's a whole lot of people who are kind of out there who don't want to buy the previous model because it's not that much newer as far as the specs and stuff than what they would be replacing. So we'll keep an eye on that one. And then iPhone rumors. Of course, we've only got a little more than a month. We've got about 6 weeks for that to be rumored up and get really cranked up before they have to actually, you know, announce something. Ming-Chi Kuo has twice claimed that the next 5.5-inch iPhone, tentatively referred to as the iPhone 7 Plus, that's the bigger one, that'll carry 3 gigs of RAM for improved performance, and now Digitimes is echoing that same report. So they stopped short of saying whether the 4.7-inch, 5.5-inch, or both iPhone 7 models will have 3 gigs of RAM, but in general, that would mark an increase over the 2 gig of RAM in the iPhone 6S, the 6S Plus, and the iPhone SE. So not sure if it's going to happen. Deutsche Bank has also thrown its weight behind the 3 gigabytes of RAM rumor, although its prediction is likely based on Quo, so it's sort of echo chamber stuff. And then the last one is that the rumors are, as far as dates for things, that Apple will release the next-gen iPhone on Friday, September 16th. And the other thing is that the iPhone 6 SE, in other words, not having it be a full cycle upgrade to like an iPhone 7, that still is on the table, that it hasn't been decided what to name it. The typical window is a 2-week wait between announcement and release. This is not feasible in the 2016 calendar, assuming a Friday, September 16th release, unless they have the event in late August. Assuming Apple wants to stay in the September timeframe, the most likely dates are September 5th or September 6th, with pre-orders on that Friday, with the official launch just a week later. We'll probably know by mid-August, because the press invites would need to go out, and those will officially confirm the date of the actual event. It's Evan Blass is the leak enthusiast who said that it will be the released the week of the 12th on Friday, September 16th. He's well known in the technology community for product leaks, especially regarding Android devices. It doesn't have such a good record on Apple. And they're still back and forth about, like I said, the iPhone 7 or the iPhone 6 SE. So that's all the Apple-y rumors, at least for this week. I picked up, one of the things tonight for the show is last week we had the pledge drive, which went very well, and thank you to our great listeners for supporting the show and helping us reach our goal. But I had gotten articles and stuff together in case we did get to do a regular show. I didn't get to use any of them, so I used them to fill in the some of this stuff. If you followed the links last week, then you'd already read some of this stuff, but we hadn't reported it on the air, so I included them. Awesome. And that's Apple stuff.
Apple stuff. I got to say, what is my MacBook Air about this Mac? What year did I get this thing?
2013.
Mid-2013 MacBook Air.
Oh, mine's older. Mine's mid-2011.
Humming along, though. I mean, that's a three-year-old computer I have not reloaded the operating system on. I mean, I've upgraded as they've come out, but it runs fine.
You've got 8 gigs of RAM in yours, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I only have 4 in mine.
Yeah, 8 gigs. Yeah. No,
mine's a 4, because mine was when 4 was the max.
Well, it's also, is yours have an SSD drive?
Yeah.
Yeah, they do.
They all do. They mine, all do. The
256 or 5?
256? I think it's 256. Let's see. Let's find out. I did splurge and get the i7.
Yeah, I got the i7 1.7.
Yeah, 256.
Where can I find that? Let's see.
That's in there somewhere.
Yeah, got to find out.
If you go to under the Apple about this Mac.
Yeah, I'm there. What section? ATA?
No, it's in the first one. Just go back to the main doodad and hit the hoobajubes at the top of the screen.
Oh, storage.
There you go.
There it is. Ah, 500 gig.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yours is superior in every way.
As it should be. But, you know, I don't make the Ars Technica money that allows me to buy a new computer every time one comes out.
My 2011 MacBook. My 2012 iMac at home.
You limp along with that. What else? What other kind of hardware do you have in your house?
Well, I could show you my...
Yeah, I could show it on a camera. Do you have a camera in your server room or
no,
whatever that is?
No.
Do you have a server room in your house?
I have the closet of the bedroom that is my office.
The closet of doom?
Is got my... It's got my servers in it. Let's see. If you go to bigdinosaur.org/about.html, I think that's the right URL. Yeah, that'll show you my that's my little server closet there, with my UPSs and my NAS
floor.
And stuff. Well, yeah.
Oh, now would probably be a good time to tell you that Barrett said he's live streaming the audio from our show out at DEF CON tonight.
Come at me, bro.
Was that Big Dragon? Big Dinosaur?
Bigdinosaur.org. That's my little domain I run. I've got a bunch of different ones. That one is the one that I use for most of my stuff. I have a well secured and well taken care of stack. It's not going to save me if you happen to have a Varnish or Nginx zero day handy, but otherwise I am secure. No, nothing is totally secure, but I'm good. I'm as good as you can get.
As good as you can. He is as good as you can get, Laura.
Yeah.
Zing. All right. So we are.
So people been following Mr. Robot?
I am still not caught up.
I haven't even watched the first one. I'm so lame.
I just got caught up. I'm all the way caught up.
Is it getting good?
The
season seems to be dragging a little bit, like the first two seasons of Better Call Saul.
I like the first two seasons of Better Call Saul.
They need to ramp it up, man. They need to ramp it up.
Come on, action. But I also watched Stranger Things on Netflix. The 80s.
I keep hearing about Stranger Things, and I think that Groovehouse has told me to watch that.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah,
it starts slow too, though. That's one of those where until it was about 4 or 5 episodes in, we didn't really get. We kept watching because it's like, geez, is there more? Is there something here?
Awesome.
But it's supposed to be kind of a creepy, kind of slowly unfolding thing, right?
Right.
Spielberg-esque 80s.
Homage.
It's very 80s.
Homage to Spielberg.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Mr. Robot seems a little slow. So you kind of want more to have... it's sort of all happening in his head, or a lot more is happening in his head, and it's a little bit...
Yeah, it's a little...
I'll agree.
Yeah. So, we'll see.
I haven't.
Yeah, well, hopefully, it's one of those where you kind of go, I mean, they did the equivalent of, drop the atomic bomb at the end of the first season. And it's really sort of funny because it doesn't seem, you don't really seem to see much in the way of consequences of that yet. and you know, where it's sort of like you would think that something on the scale of what happened, I'm just going to speak about it vaguely. I mean, obviously at the end of a season, there's going to be a big thing on any show. But it's like, it doesn't seem like it has that many ripples, which you'd expect more. Anyway,
I'll pick it up at some point.
I guess you need to try buy or fry it.
Yay.
And we can crank that one up. I think there's some good ones this week.
Hit it.
In the geek world, we hear about new gadgets and gizmos every day. But can they stand a dip
in the snark tank?
So first up, virtual reality. Samsung new Galaxy Note 7 is the first Note to use USB-C, which is apparently good for many reasons, not the least of which is it makes it easier to plug in when it's dark. But it also means you'll need a new Gear VR headset if you want to enjoy the wonders of virtual reality with it. So it's a good thing that they announced the Gear VR for Note 7 along with the new phone. So if you're in the market for a new phone and you want to get into a phone-driven VR experience, it's apparently an upgrade from the prior one. It's got 101 degrees field of view instead of 96. And it's finished in a shade of blue so dark it's almost black. So that could be a nice feature if that helps you decide which VR you want. It does address complaints that the earlier all-white models created reflections. And apparently they also overhauled the input controls at the temple. The touchpad is recessed and got quite a bit bigger. Dedicated button takes you to the Oculus store without dealing with menus. And apparently they said the padding seems cushier and comfier and that it's noticeably lighter than the previous version. So that's always good news. The pass-through power and peripheral port on the bottom is now a USB-C connector, as is the native phone connection. It does have a dongle so that you can use older micro USB connected Galaxy phones. In all likelihood, it signals that the next generation of Galaxy phones will use USB-C. So it's no longer for just the MacBook, the one MacBook anymore. USB-C is kind of starting to be there. And so you wonder, well, does that mean Apple will avoid it because everybody else is using it, or will they follow along? So apparently the VR thing is continuing. It's not a, you know, they keep advancing and improving stuff. So if you're a VR enthusiast, that's a positive sign. Of course, you have to be into the Samsung, the Samsung phones and that to use the Gear, but still thought it was a good measure of if they're still coming out with new stuff and they're getting better, they're improving the specs, that usually is a good sign in a tech product.
Yeah, I mean, Gear VR is and has always been, and I think will always be, kind of
your friend.
It is your friend. No, it's kind of it's the free taste. It's the teaser to make you realize that, oh my gosh, there's something to VR this time around. You know, it's not amazing compared to the super expensive headsets, but it is pretty cool. I mean, you slap your phone in there, you download some of the demos, or you play some of the little games they've got, or they've got the movie, you can watch movies on it or whatever. And it's impressive, and you can kind of turn your head around and it follows your view. It doesn't have the full motion tracking like the expensive headsets do, but it does rotational tracking, so you can move your head back and forth, and you look at it and it's enough to give you that taste for you to want to go and like look at what the real VR stuff is, and for what it does, it's pretty good.
I guess it lets people dip their toe in, yeah. So it's nice to see sort of the pushing up from the bottom with a company that has a brand name that people can make an informed decision about, rather than some of these fringier, Chinese brands where it's like, okay, well, this could be cheap but great, or it could just be cheap and cheap.
Cheap and cheap.
So, another stuff on grilling, since it's summer, this one actually looked like it's got kind of an interesting option. Usually, so if you don't have a grill, you're starting with nothing, then the tough part is deciding, you know, are you going to go with something that you burn wood in, charcoal, or you can gas one, you know, which way to go? Because usually you can only afford to just do one. There's one called the Volcano Grill, which is a good name, as long as it gets hot enough. They have solved that dilemma. They have it where you can switch between gas, charcoal, or wood by adding. You can add a propane adapter to it, and it's portable, so it's like a tailgate or campsite kind of thing. And so you can switch it between a grill, a Dutch oven, a wok, or even a fire pit, and it's only about $150. And it's actually not a Kickstarter; it's actually for sale. You can go to Amazon if you're interested in it. There's another, see, like the VR thing, you can get your Samsung VR and do VR while you grill with gas, charcoal, or wood all at the same time. And you'll have spent less than a grand. So there's that. See, this one, I just thought this was weird enough that I wanted to stick it in here. Cause geodesic domes are cool, except, you know, whenever you look at the idea of building one, and perhaps the pricing on this one is not, they talk about it as inexpensive or as affordable, but I think it's on the bleeding edge of affordable, or their definition is. But the nice part is it's kits. There's a company called Freedomes that has been making event domes for about 10 years, which those were like ginormous ones. You know, you can have a concert in or a museum or whatever. Now they've got a new line that you could do in your backyard for like luxury camping or outdoor classrooms. They started about $4,000, but it says that you can assemble, like the smallest one can be assembled in 4 or 5 hours. They have two lines on the like ones that normal humans can potentially afford. I mean, it's kind of the price of a cheap used car. They have the glamping dome and the classic dome. The glamping dome includes a panoramic bay window, and you can even insulate it so you could be inside it in cold weather, which for you know, if you're in our Houston listenership, then obviously you're never going to need it to be insulated for winter. They have four sizes. The smallest size is 20 square meters or 215 square feet in English. And like I said, can be assembled in 4 or 5 hours. They can go off the grid and can have wood-burning stoves. F-Dome said they can withstand extreme weather, including coastal winds and heavy snowfalls. So the price is mainly they've targeted them at hotels, but it would be kind of cool to be able to put up a dome in your backyard just because you wanted to.
And then watch square it fall apart, like the one that we have down there on the south side.
Whee!
Well, yeah, for $4,000, you might be able to pick up the eighth wonder of the world as a dome that you could use, but it wouldn't fit in your backyard, and the maintenance is a lot more.
You don't have to maintain it, as we've proven.
The classic dome is more for winter garden, playground, or yoga dome. The yoga dome. I'm going out to the yoga dome.
Better than the yogurt.
Down, down.
Two flavors enter, one flavor leaves.
Yeah, see, we need to make our own aggressive model of the dome, and it can be the Thunder Dome. Well, I don't know why they didn't do that why the classic dome, but the company says the self-assembled domes are made of durable materials that can resist weather like wind and snow, and even earthquakes, which doesn't help us here. They say the domes do not cost the earth, but still perform great. Google uses a lot of them. They use the classic 75, which is about 800 square feet, for the Google for Education program in the UK. They used it as a traveling classroom to show how technology could change education. You know, basically, it looks like it's like a metal tube frame that you connect together, and then it also looks like it has some cables that that connect it up. But maybe if it got really cold, we could put up a dome at the parking lot of Cons. The roof of the dome is coming up at Cons.
I don't know. It feels like it's never actually going to be cold outside again. I'm in that stage of my summer doldrum feelings.
Or you could put it up and you leave it sort of open on the sides, and then it can be a shade dome. Or close it up. Or you can go full Houston style, close it up and put an industrial air conditioner next to it and set it at about 40 degrees and have people be in there.
Now you're
the
talking.
The ice dome. The Houston ice dome.
There we go.
Charge people to come in it. Let's see. Some quick hits. Dropbox Paper is their competition to Google Docs. So if you're a Dropbox fan, it's in beta. You can get it in beta for Android and iOS. That's, I think, free for now. So if you're a Dropbox fanatic, you can go and find it. Obviously, there's a lot of competition in this area, like, you know, Box, Google, and Microsoft offer similar tools, which Dropbox didn't. So this is kind of them trying to keep up. But according to some people, Dropbox Paper is definitely a cool product. So, and they supposedly, compared to Google Docs, it's designed to be more visually appealing. I don't know. It keeps getting tough because they keep all of them want to be the category killer, and so you have to commit. It seems like
Google Docs looks fine. I mean, you know, most people probably use it pretty regularly. I mean, you know, maybe I'm an outlier, but I'm in various Google Docs documents a couple of times a day. It seems looks all right.
As opposed to, well, you know, I think Google seems to be they're sort of the, nobody's gotten fired for, you know, recommending Google Docs. I guess there's Word has their thing with the online, the Word 360 or the Office 360 stuff where it kind of integrates all that. I haven't had need for that level of, so far I haven't had that need for that level of editing of stuff. So I was using Evernote, but now they're trying to make money. And so they keep narrowing down what you can do for free, even though I'm not at the, like, I'm not even anywhere near the ceiling of their data. Now they've narrowed it down. So you have to choose two devices or pay extra. And, so I've been moving more to like Notes, which is tied to iCloud and is free. Cause that's all I've really needed. I guess the other piece to it that I haven't had to do is, and that Google Docs and Paper both do is collaborative writing environments. So if you need that, something like that, you might want to check out Dropbox Paper if you're already into Dropbox. And then, these two kind of go together. Nintendo, they've talked about it for a couple weeks, but it's all been on a couple weeks when we were A, preempted and B, doing fun drives. So if you already know all about this, you can, I don't know, take a quick bathroom break or whatever. No, it's the NES Classic Edition. It looks like a Nintendo, basically the old Nintendo Entertainment System, except it's small. So you can order it and pretend that you're now a giant. You know, when you were a kid, that NES was huge because you were small. Now you can be ginormous because it'll fit in your palm. And the deal is it doesn't take cartridges. It hooks up to your TV with an HDMI cable. And it has a controller that's designed to work like the original, you know, rectangular NES gamepad. The gamepad that it comes with will connect to a Wii remote. So you can also use it to play virtual console games on a Wii or a Wii U if you're so inclined. The deal is that you don't add new games to it. It comes with 30 games, and that's it. But it's only $60, and it's going to come out November 11th. So if you either are a young person who wants to go old school and do retro gaming, or if you're an old person who wants to capture your glory days when you could, you know, because you got to figure at least for the first 3 or 4 days, you'll be able to beat the youngsters at, you know, Super Mario Brothers or any of those, the Excitebike, any of those things that they've never played and you actually did back in the day. And frankly, the price, it's relatively a deal. Because the 30 games are actually pretty legit. Stuff like Castlevania, Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., Super Mario Brothers, Super Mario Brothers 2 and 3, Legend of Zelda and Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link are in there, Kirby's Adventure. So there's a pretty good selection, Mega Man 2. There's a lot of stuff, lots of things that if you want to be a kind of completist on your gaming, that these would help. And if you bought them, one of the things I've seen is that the visuals when you hook it up to a TV are a lot clearer than on the console, doing the virtual console stuff on a Wii. And if you got all 30 games, if you got more than, I think they charge $4 or $5 a game for the virtual ones, the console ones. So if you're going to get more than about 10 of these, you're better off just buying the little mini console thing. But if you happen to be somebody who's like, buy it when it's already made, I need to build my own and run my own retro games on it, then you can do RetroPie, which is a it allows you to turn your Raspberry Pi into a retro gaming machine. It builds upon Raspbian, Emulation Station, RetroArch, and many other projects to enable you to play your favorite arcade, home console, and classic PC games with a minimum setup. So they have they keep it up. It's a current one, and they even offer some of the kind of extra little things that you need to, you know, some extra hardware stuff and all that available there. But the main, the RetroPie thing is a free download. So if you want to, if you're already into Raspberry Pi and you want to make yourself a cool retro thing like that, or if your kid is asking for the Nintendo one and you just want to, you know, make them jump through some hoops before they can start playing Mario Brothers or whatever, well, then you can go with RetroPie. So,
I like pie. You know,
I like pie.
Pie's good.
I like pie.
I like pie.
So, and retro pies.
It's like how pie used to be.
Yeah, yeah, back in the 80s. I don't know. Was that a peak for pie? I guess if you watch Twin Peaks.
I used to watch Pie Peaks. That was that
show.
That with show pie. With pie.
Yeah, that show that was all about pies. Before Food Network, even, it was about pies.
Hello, pie.
Let's
see. And here's one. This is sort of weird. The hoverboard business came about because Segways were too expensive, and so companies made cheap knockoffs and sold them, and then they started catching on fire and overheating and sparking and all that. So now it's, I guess, sort of the revenge of Segway is that they've made their own device that goes into that space, that does the hoverboard space, partly because they know they are pretty sure this will sell because it's under $1,000, and they built it so it won't catch on fire or explode. And so it's gone through, I believe it's gone through the Underwriters Laboratories successfully, so they know that it was not going to, so that it will not be catching fire and causing, I don't know, rider deaths and so on. There actually
property
is a standard.
Mostly, it looks like.
Yeah, really. There's now actually a standard to define a safe hoverboard from UL Underwriters Laboratories, which is now they just call themselves UL because they're, you know, cool. Now they're cool that way, but so Segway's got one that looks kind of like a bar stool on a hoverboard. It's the mini hoverboard. Segway's been working on this apparently for a few years, and that their goal is to bring the innovation of the big Segway into a smaller package. They wanted a product that the average person could use that had a price point under $1,000. It doesn't have any handlebars. Instead, you use a knee pad to steer it around. Wired had it, and the guy rode it, and he said that riding the Segway feels very different than a lot of hoverboards. It's sturdy and consistent. He said it moves smoothly, turns crisply, and never bucks like a Bronco when you're on it. It has pneumatic tires, so it can go on bumpy sidewalks and even functionally move across grass. So there's that. You control the steering with your knees. And the reviewer said that the steering feels a little odd, like you're skiing on wheels, but works really well. Let's see. And there's a companion app for your phone that'll give you stats, let you control the device remotely. And it forces you to go through a tutorial before you can unlock the top speed of the Mini Pro. They said the app is kind of a buggy mess, but at least it's an indication Segway is trying to thoughtfully introduce people to the devices. Let's see, the mini board, they want to move past being a Tickle Me Elmo level fad toy and into something more like the future of transportation. Isn't that what the Segway was supposed to be?
I wonder if maybe
they're going to circle around the back so that then eventually the full-on Segway will become a real thing.
It changed tourism. I mean, you see everywhere you go now, they have, take the Segway tour of Madrid, take the Segway tour of Paris. It's a great way to
You'd have thought that at some point the production, that the price would have been dropping to where normal people would buy one without, you know, it's still one of those where you have to spend so much that nobody else has one, you know, if you got one. The best use I saw for one was there was a guy that lived in a neighborhood near where I lived recently, and he's a veteran and he had lost both of his legs, and he had one of the like kind of all terrain Segways. Apparently the VA wrote a newspaper article about him, but he had got one of those and he was using it to go to the grocery store and stuff like that, because he couldn't walk up the hills in this part of San Antonio without suffering. So that was cool. But I mean, it's like buying a car, unfortunately, or a geodesic dome, you know?
Mm.
If you got to choose between a Segway and a geodesic dome, I mean, that's a tough choice.
Gosh, what do I want for my crazy person compound?
Oh, if only I could have both or have multiple Segways and then dome battles on the that's Thunder.
Between your Segway, what's the next story?
So, this one is just, it sounds weirder than it is. There's a veggie burger that is apparently designed to convert people from eating beefy hamburgers. And the way that it works is that this is a veggie burger that bleeds. Yeah. I think maybe a better way to put it is it's a veggie burger that is moist and juicy. Might be a better way to put it.
Is this the lab-grown meat?
No, it's not. It's actually all vegetable material.
Hmm.
Yeah, they found a well, it's going to be served at David Chang's Momofuku Nishi, which is a big deal restaurant in New York, for $12, which this is in New York, so they say that's an affordable hamburger. David Chang told Eater he was, quote, genuinely blown away by the burger, because he is not a vegetarian. This isn't one of those like hair shirt kind of veggie thing. It's made from an ingredient cocktail that includes wheat, coconut oil, and potato protein, but the magic comes from, it's H-E-M-E, so I don't know if is that heme or a hemi. Hemi? Does this burger got a hemi? It's a molecule that gives meat its distinctive flavor and texture and bloodiness, I think juiciness better. But the deal is that they can get this molecule from plants, from beans, and so that's where they got it, so that the whole thing's vegetarian. It's not like you're getting a veggie burger that they've then injected with, you know, animal products or something. So I guess we'll see once if this spreads around more and more people eat it. But maybe first thing is stop saying that it's a burger that bleeds, and saying that it's a juicy veggie burger might be the first step. Maybe that's why veggie burgers haven't taken off, because they don't know how to market them. But and then what do you want to go with your veggie burger? How about a beer that's made by a new solar-powered machine that converts urine into beer? I mean, we're all familiar with the opposite deal, and it doesn't even take solar power, where you convert beer into, you know, where you rent beer, as people say. But actually, it came from a technology to do off-the-grid methods to create drinkable water. But This was done in Belgium, and they developed an energy efficient system for developing countries with developing countries in mind, where solar power is optimal. By collecting urine in a heated tank and passing it through a membrane, clean drinking water is collected, as well as nutrients to be used as fertilizer. And then they used it at a 10-day music and theater event where the pee of thousands of festival goers was turned into 1,000 liters of drinkable water. And then they took the water and they're brewing it into beer. So, you know, some of it is you wonder, did they have to treat it that much to get the alcohol level up for beer at the music festival? But the big question that one has to ask is, would you drink it? I guess the beer, you know, if they brewed it into beer, then it's got alcohol in it. So it's not like it'd have any. Although, and I guess technically, you know, urine is sterile. It's not that I'm out there. I'd have to think about the tap that comes out of the machine.
Sure.
Taking a big glass off of it. But anyways, so there's that. So would you, maybe we could get them to set one up at a geek gathering and,
I'll watch you drink.
Yeah, the other problem is the geek gathering's at night, so I guess it wouldn't really process it very well.
We'd have to plan. We'd have to have it set up the day before. call Cone and have him get on that.
We can put it under the dome. So, yeah, so they call it. Oh, I forgot the money quote. The one of the creators of the machine says, "We call it from sewer to brewer."
Oh,
that's better than the bleeding veggie burger. So we'll give them that.
Womp womp.
I mean, at least they're still work. At least they're still trying. Because I've had some really, really wretched veggie burgers. I don't know if you've ever tried them, but
I've had some okay ones, but not very. They're not compelling enough to make me want to switch away from actual meat.
Yeah, I mean,
they're not a substitute for a burger. It's more like, oh, hey, I'd like something that tasted like vaguely like veggies that I could throw in a bun, maybe.
Yeah, but it's a veggie burger. You're eating a veggie burger, you know you're eating a veggie burger. It's because it is. It's, you know, it's like a black bean burger or whatever kind of veggie burger it is. But it's not. It's not. You're not eating it thinking, like, this is a surprisingly tasty hamburger. Oh, my gosh, I have been fooled. No, not at all. And that's not the point.
I'm guessing if they're selling it at Momofuku, though, that guy's not going to sell something that people are eating because they're trying to save the world. So maybe that one's going to be maybe that's going to inject flavor into the veggie burger world. So, well, there's only science stuff left, so we should probably save that till later. I know Jay is going to DEF CON. I've been thinking about and looking at the reviews for Suicide Squad and wondering if that was going to be a good idea to go see or not.
Well, the preview for it looks good. It looks like it should be good, but the reviews are not coming across great.
Yeah. They seem sort of mixed, and I kind of wonder. That sounds like they're not sure what story they want to tell.
I think I'm going to see it, but I'll see it in a theater where you can eat and drink, emphasis on the drink, so that, you know, either even if it's bad, I still come out ahead.
Sounds like it might have been a more interesting movie if they just showed the making of, because apparently Jared Leto is a method actor, and he was in character as the Joker 100% of the time while they made the movie.
Lovely.
Apparently he couldn't be on set during one particular time, and so he had his stooges. They had some. He gave some sort of presents to everybody because he wasn't there, and then they threw a large pig carcass on the table at the crafts, you know, the craft table or whatever. Just because.
Yeah, he reportedly gave Margot Robbie a rat in a box, a dead rat in a box, and just not. You know.
Well, I think it was alive because I think if I remembered right, she put it on a little leash and took it for walks and
I thought it was dead.
Had a cage for it and all that. That'd be a lot creepier if she took it for walks.
Well, you just kind of drag it. It doesn't really walk. Just sort of take it for drags.
But it'd be interesting. I guess at the end of the summer we'll have to do a retrospective and see which superhero movies succeeded. You know, which big blockbusters succeeded and which ones bombed. I mean, so far, well, I think Ghostbusters. I wouldn't put it as a massive hit, but apparently it has paid for itself.
Apparently it is not horribly terrible.
And Independence Day, that I think that officially is a bomb.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that one sort of like appeared and vanished. It's gone.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah. I don't think it's even, I mean, if it's still in theaters, you don't hear anything about it. It just sort of like flashed and then vanished.
Yeah, I have a feeling that one's going to show up in Redbox and on-demand video before it gets awfully cold this fall.
Yeah.
Like yeah, they I do.
So. Not really so, all that great. I mean, like you needed somebody to tell you that, you know, Independence Day 2 was not going to be amazing. I mean, you could kind of probably guess that one. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. Look, the first movie wasn't all that great either, but it was certainly fun.
Well, because it was the first time you saw stuff blow up real good, but it's sort of how do they, yeah, how do you top it? How do after you blow up most of the major landmarks on the planet, and then we destroy the big ships, then how do you top that? It sounds like they decided to top it by making it like the group that we defeated, if I remember the description right, the group that we had defeated was like just some kind of small scouting operation, real fringe.
Right, now and the real aliens come back, are coming.
The badasses are coming. You know?
Welcome to Earth.
Welcome to Earth.
you're right. The first one was a lot of fun, and it was a 4th of July movie. It was a feel good, you know.
Me and my friends, we went to go see it on opening night. We lined up with all the other idiots and had a great time.
No, it
wasn't quality entertainment or anything, but it was certainly fun enough.
Yeah, I love, you know, part one of my, since I don't worry about spoiling Independence Day, the first one, for anybody at this point, because if you haven't seen it, you know, I bear no, it's not my fault, but you can tell that they were, I think it was rated PG because they wanted everybody to see it, which meant that the ultimate moment when Randy Quaid, you know, in the words of my generation,
right.
In the words of my generation, up yours, is right. Just not quite as inspiring as, oh, I don't know, any number of other action movies where it's sort of the last kind of, you know, the big line from the person who's going to defeat the enemy, you know, once and for all.
Right.
So
that's that, a good that, moment,
that,
though.
That always struck me as jarring when he did it.
It was there was the whole thing about, like, after the aliens attack, they were... You know, maybe we should go to Area 51 where you guys have all those aliens and stuff. There's no, we don't have any aliens in Area 51. This is Bill Pullman as the president is telling him there's no aliens in Area 51. And then the aides are like, actually, sir, that's not entirely correct. it was good. It was a good, fun. Oh, it wasn't good. It was a fun movie. It was a movie very much of its day.
Yeah. It was a blew up real good movie, which there is a place for those in the movie world.
It was what my friends and I used to call a cool movie, not a good movie, but a very cool movie.
Yeah, I guess one thing that's interesting in movie trends, you know, with all the interest in these different movies like Suicide Squad or any of these others, it seems like Hollywood has actually gotten better at hiding or else maybe because people have figured out that it sort of sucks when the movie is spoiled before you go and see it. But it seemed like there was a period of time where the reveals were generally out there too real early on movies on what the big thing was. And nowadays they seem to be a lot more successful at keeping the script from, you know, leaking.
Some of them do, yeah. But, I mean, then you see movies like, what was the Terminator movie? Terminator Genesis, the one that came out a year or two ago?
Salvation?
No, that's the one with Christian Bale. The recent one was Genesis, I think. And where the trailer just gave the whole movie away. Like, spoiled not only, like, the hook to get you into the movie, but then spoiled the big twist in the end of the movie, too. I was like, man, come on.
Oh, well, you know, people are old enough. Terminator 2... Well, I guess two Terminator stories. One is I had a friend who had gone to see it, and these friends who dragged me to see it, and I knew nothing about it at all. So I just went in cold. I knew Schwarzenegger was in it. That was about
it. You're talking about the first one or the second one?
the first one.
Okay.
And that was just awesome. You know, that really, you know, you didn't know what the hell was, you know, it was a real fun ride. And then the second one, Arnold went on all the talk shows and ruined the first 20 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, I'm good.
You're not
now.
Supposed to know. You're not supposed to know. He's like, oh yeah, this time I'm a good guy.
Yeah, I'm good.
And
I'm good
it's
time.
Like, you're not supposed to know that until 20 minutes in. And so the first 20 minutes you're watching it, and it's and I watched the movie and I was kind of seething because it's like, you know, if I didn't know that he was the good guy, this would be a whole lot more exciting.
Yeah, it's
and
a brilliantly
challenging.
Structured movie. I mean, and they play it even though like the movie's marketing spoiled it too. Like it was all in the trailers and everything, in addition to the talk show stuff. But even knowing it going in, they still play it totally straight. And you know, they do the whole thing where it's like target acquired, and then there's that pivotal, like the moment where the first act ends, the climax of the first act, when Arnold and the T-1000, you know, they meet in that hallway in the back of the shopping mall, and John's there, and they both have guns, and it's like, I don't know, I mean, I thought I knew what was going to happen, but what's going to happen? And then, you know, get down, and then it goes from there, and it was so well done. It's such a, that is a benchmark excellent movie.
Has there been any more talk about a new Alien movie?
Yeah, there's two in work. There's Ridley Scott is finishing up, and I think has wrapped photography on what was Prometheus 2 and is now titled Alien Covenant. We're probably starting to get into the next few months. We're getting into like the press period with that, so I'll know more. Supposedly, I'm going to get to go to one of the junkets for that, so I may be able to interview Ridley Scott about it. So that's coming up, and then there is, so who was the District 9 guy? What's his name?
Verhoeven?
No. Neil Blomkamp has a, supposedly has a script for a movie, for an Aliens movie that would pick up, it would sort of jettison Alien 3 and everything that came after, and it would pick up after Aliens with Sigourney Weaver and Michael Biehn. Possibly with Carrie Henn in it, who played Newt, and has since like hasn't done any movies since then. And so he supposedly has this script, and there's a bunch of concept art for it, and the movie was sort of greenlit and then tabled when Ridley Scott decided that it wasn't going to be Prometheus 2 he was doing. It was going to, like, the movie was going to change into Alien Covenant. So those are going to be the two. One absolutely coming out, and then the other maybe coming out over the next couple of years. But Alien Covenant is Prometheus 2, and that will be the next one up. And it's, they're saying, I mean, originally it was going to be a straight sequel to Prometheus. In the end of Prometheus, what's her name? Noomi Rapace and Fassbender, you know, they take off in the alien ship and they're going somewhere, right? Supposedly going to the alien homeworld. And they're not, Noomi Rapace isn't in the movie, the second one. It's just going to be Fassbender and then a bunch of other people. I don't know where it fits in with the continuity, so okay. we will find out.
I need to rewatch Prometheus.
It is probably both better and worse than you remember. I mean, yeah. It's got some quality stuff in it. Like, it's not, it sort of falls apart when you really focus on it, but you know, it's not terrible.
It's Alien think too meets much about it.
It's yeah. Alien meets Cosmos.
It's, I mean, yeah, that's, yes, that really good way of putting it. And it started off being much more of a direct line Alien prequel, and it went through like 40 rewrites.
Yeah.
Is it Damian Lindelof? Is he the one who did the script? Let me see. Prometheus. I think it was Lindelof did the final shooting script. Let's see. Prometheus, 2012 film, a science fiction film directed by Ridley Scott. Yeah, John Spates and Damian Lindelof did the writing of the final shooting script. Lindelof is, of course, the fellow who also brought us Lost and a couple of other horrifying things. The Prometheus shifted from a direct Alien prequel into sort of, yeah, it's kind of a prequel, but it's kind of not because there's kind of stuff, and it's kind of...
Yeah, I wanted it to be a real prequel. Like, where did that spaceship come from? And, you know, tell us the story of the ship that they found in the first Alien movie, which is what I thought it was going to be. And they didn't.
Well, yeah, and they went off into this whole, like, there's, they get off into, like, the, you know, the creation myth and, like, the Ur myth behind, you know, humanity and these engineers, and it's just, it very, very much exceeded its grasp. And it should, where they could have, it should have been, I think, as someone who loves the Aliens universe, it could have just slam dunked it as a prequel if they just kept the scope narrow. But instead, they wanted to go all metaphysical and get into, you know, where does life come from?
So they wanted a floating bubble baby.
Kind of, yeah, yes. They wanted to 2001 it, I guess. I generally trust Ridley Scott. You know, he's been going to space for many, many years and many, many different movies, but I think he whiffed on this one.
Well, has anybody else seen the most recent Star Trek movie? That was another one that came out like right in the middle of our kind of long hiatus.
Not yet.
I've heard mixed on that too. Unfortunately, it sounds like...
I saw it. I didn't. I saw it. It's not one where you like. You know, I guess to be ultra geeky about it, it didn't blow you away like Wrath of Khan at its time did. You know, where the end was just really blew you away. But it's a good, solid movie. I didn't walk out of it feeling ripped off or feeling shorted in any way. It doesn't have a traditional arc to its story. But it's not like, you know, I'm not giving out any spoilers, but I mean, basically it's
about the Enterprise.
There's interesting stuff happening. They aren't bad about, you know, pulling out where, you know, in some of the other ones where they pull out, oh, well, here's this, oh, wait, yet undiscovered form of matter that lets us do some other thing that we need to do with the MacGuffin point of this movie. They don't have that kind of stuff. It's Simon Pegg wrote it, and it's fairly solid. They have, you know, it's entertaining to watch, and it's better than the trailer, I guess I'll say that, because the stuff on the trailer made it look like it was some kind of Fast and Furious 5 kind of movie.
The trailer seems to indicate that they've destroyed yet another starship.
There is that.
I just don't know how many times they have to do that.
The thing is, though, they do that. It happens pretty early. So it's not like the usual deal where they get to the end of the movie and then you know that the whole next movie is going to be, well, what are they going to do? Kind of thing. So,
well,
it's watchable. If you like Star Trek and if you like the other movies, you won't be disappointed.
I mean, I'll have to see it because I have to see Star Trek. I have to see Star Wars. Those
in Houston, movies. It's on that like multi-screen thing where it's like three screens and they film special stuff to make all three work at the same time.
Okay. Interesting.
I'll have to look up on it. We can talk about it next week.
All right. Well, that music tells us it's time to go, and I got to go stress out before I can fall asleep for a few hours before I get up and catch my flight to Las Vegas for DEF CON. So I'm going to hook up with Barrett and Flicted and a whole cast of Houston Irregulars that'll be there.
So you'll be in airplane mode for the next 4 days.
Yes. All right. Well, you've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Thanks, Groovehouse.
The National Convention of the Green Party of the United States will be held this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the University of Houston Student Center. You are invited to attend. There'll be workshops on Thursday afternoon and Friday that include removing constitutional rights from corporations, art and revolution, and the nature of systemic change in the U.S. The Presidential Nominating Convention will be held Saturday afternoon and include keynote speeches by Cornel West and Yana Indigo, a leader in the Bernie or Bust movement. You can register for the convention at the door or attend without needing to register the welcoming event on Thursday evening at 7 p.m. or the Party for the Revolution, a real party, hosted on Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Parking is inexpensive at the parking garage on Elgin just north of Wheeler. If you can't be there, you can hear Pacifica's in-depth coverage of the convention, including presumptive candidate Jill Stein's acceptance speech, from 1 to 5 p.m. on Saturday, live on KPFT, hosted by KPFT's Mark Babawi, and broadcast on Pacifica stations throughout the nation. Again, there'll be a live broadcast of the Green Party National Convention from 1 to 5 p.m. on Saturday here on KPFT, Houston.
Why donate your car to KPFT? You can free up space in your garage, you can avoid the hassles of selling your car, there's no need to pay hefty car repair bills, and you turn that unwanted car into an IRS tax deduction. In addition, you're helping to make the Houston area better with unique arts, music, and culture. You help keep options on the airwaves. Best of all, making a car donation is easy and always free. Just call 1-855-573-8227 or visit kpft.org to donate your old vehicle to support KPFT. Again, that number is 1-855-KPFT-CAR. Thanks for your help. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.